Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Oh, hello. It's Thursday, and it's time to welcome you to Waypoints, where the Waypoint staff and friends take a break to nerd out and deep dive on the art, culture, and entertainment that's been inspiring and provoking us lately. Gathered around the table this Thursday, we've got Natalie Watson. and we've got Patrick Kleppick.
I looked at Natalie. I made mistakes for me.
All right, well, this has all worked out extremely well. Speaking of things, Rob, working out well, Patrick, did you see the most innovative, creative football play of 2019 so far?
Of the world?
Yes. You know, it's
maybe in history.
You know, some people say you should be looking towards where the ball should be going. Patrick Mahomes showed once in the NFL this year, you actually don't. You don't have to look where you're throwing. But then the AAF, the always innovative, at least now I'm on this bandwagon, one of their quarterbacks realized, you know what? Why even look forward, left or right? Why not turn all the way around and toss the ball backwards like it's a fucking bouquet to all of your friends and just see if someone catches it? And the receiver caught it!
See, this little play known as the Sigourney, and that team's been practicing that for, you know, well, like all the teams in the AAF, been practicing it for definitely a couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
That's about how well-drilled these teams all look. But the amazing thing is that actually worked, and that seems to be the AAF in a nutshell. It is such a weird league, Patrick, but I kind of can't look away, and I'm starting to unironically enjoy it.
Yes, So last week on Waypoints, Natalie and Danielle helped me muddle through the eight teams because of the lack of a Chicago team to settle on our boys at in Orlando, the Orlando Apollos, as the team I'm going to root for as we make our way towards the whatever they call the Super Bowl. Something happens at the end of April where two teams face off.
The
I'm not
awesome
sure.
Awesome tub. That's the Super Bowl for the AAF, mm-hmm. which I've decided stands for Always Adventurous Football.
You know what?
Perfect.
Not wrong.
Cannot wait for the championship of the Always Adventurous Football League at the Ceasing Operations Bowl.
And so I'd set a calendar reminder, and then, I don't know, it didn't go off, or I set it incorrectly, and then like realized, like an hour and a half into the game, like, ah, shit, I was supposed to be watching my boys. And so trying to figure out, like, well, how do I even watch Great. The Apollos? And so I went to, like, the subreddit, and there was like, oh, you just go to AAF.com. And I was like, cool. Went to AAF.com, and they do have an embed for all of the games. But the league doesn't do, like, their own – it's just a live camera feed. It's, like, cutting between – different cameras, there's no commentary.
Oh my God.
There's no, you don't know what down it is. You don't know how many yards there are to go. You don't know what the score is. There's literally nothing on the screen. It's just like someone holding up their phone and just like filming the game.
Good.
And so you hear all the ambient sounds of the football game. Like you literally just hear them doing their, you know, hard hike and like calling their audibles. It's an extremely weird way to play the game that I made it through roughly 20 minutes before I said, how do I watch this with how I actually watch football? And then it turns out CBS has a feed with all the usual stuff on top of it. And so I started watching that. Although weirdly, in the NFL, it's uncommon for you to hear the actual calling of the plays on the field. Or if you hear the audibles, it's often by accident, like the microphone just happens to pick it up. I don't know if there's like an actual like bylaw or like they try to keep that stuff a secret, but you don't hear that kind of stuff often called. Mm-hmm. And in the AAF, like, the commentators are talking about it and predicting plays based on what's being called on the field by the quarterback. Like, multiple times the commentator be like, oh, like, this means, like, three guys are going to be wide right, and then a guy's going to come up the middle. And I'm like, excuse me? Like, what? And so it was an interesting wrinkle. But, yeah, my boys, the Apollos, they were down at the half. I started watching. They came back. There was a pick six by presumably some cornerback whose name I will learn after watching it for another week. And it was goofy. Like, it was fun. Yeah. It's high scoring. It's the closest thing you're going to get to watching college football without watching college football, because college football tends to be, like, much more high variant with blowouts and 40 to sixes and stuff like that. I like the fact that the 2-point conversions are required on every touchdown. That is just, it's more fun to watch an actual play than a place kicker doing something that's always going to go in. It was fun. Like, it was football. Like, it filled the, like, base level need of, like, I would like to watch some football for another couple of weeks. And apparently, I'm now not only prepared for this, but right as this finishes up, the CFL starts. So I'm just going right into the Canadian Football League after this, and I'm ready to ride.
I think that's getting weird.
Because the rules are even fucking weirder in the Canadian League, apparently.
Yeah, my only thing is, like, there was also, there's some great stuff in that Apollo versus Commanders game. There's also a really ugly looking injury, and immediately I'm thinking, like, I don't know if it's worth the risks in the pro game. I sure doubt whether it's worth the risks in the AAF game. That was the thing. Is like,
oh, for the players, you could credibly make an argument that the existence of the league, especially when it's not actually a developmental league in which there is a pipeline to get you to the NFL, it's more dangling a hope that maybe you show something and then an NFL team picks you up. That you're actually giving people a false sense of hope and participating in a unreasonably violent game in which the only argument to actually continue playing in it is if you make it to a point where you're going to make tens of millions to compensate you for the fact that you're participating in a sport like that. That is a fair criticism.
Theoretically
more if like it is competent, more money comes in where it's, you know, I don't know how much these players are being paid. Like, I'm curious to start digging into, like, that side of it. Like, it can't be a lot, but, like, is it, like, more than if you were, like, working, like, some accounting? You know what I mean? Like, are they getting paid, like, $60,000 a year? Like, I have no idea.
Yeah, but again, like, as Bomani Jones said on High Noon, with regards to, like, baseball versus football, in baseball, they just hand you the check. In football, they ball it up and beat you with it. Yeah. Before handing it over, and that's probably even truer in the AAF. Anyway, though, speaking of, I guess, potential boondoggles, Patrick, your waypoint this week is kind of more about a topic, and then there's two really good pieces of content related to it, but you've been digging into this entire saga that I think has gotten a fair bit of national attention, certainly since Scott Walker lost the election, the gubernatorial election in Wisconsin. But you've been looking at the Foxconn issue in Wisconsin this week.
Yeah, so I was sort of decided to kind of revisit this for Waypoints because recently Amazon decided to pull out their much lauded, vaunted HQ2 out of New York. I guess it's still part of it's being, it got split and part of it's still going to be in Virginia, I guess, is the I don't know the specifics on like the other half of that, but Amazon pulled out due to, you know, I'm sure we'll learn more specifics, but like seemingly largely a progressive pushback against, you know, corporate bribery, corporate welfare. I think in New York, it was going to be a little under $3 billion in potential tax breaks over time to get them to build a warehouse in a sort of like small little Amazon city. And, that's a deal that got scuttled, right? Like there was pushback, like that has been part of, you know, somewhat attributed to the election of, you know, AOC, you know, somewhat attributed to just a larger progressive, you know, Cynthia Nixon, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, I live in Illinois and it has been impossible to live in Illinois. I don't live all that far from the Wisconsin border, maybe like 45 minutes to an hour. I spent a lot of time all year in Wisconsin. I have a lot of close friends and family in Wisconsin. My family has a small place in Wisconsin. I have been hearing about this Foxconn deal for the last couple of years. So the Foxconn deal, in late 2017, Wisconsin won a bidding process to offer $4.5 billion, the largest public subsidy to a foreign company in American history. It is 10x, roughly, what other similar subsidies has been. Foxconn, if you aren't familiar with the name Foxconn, you are at least probably vaguely aware of, like, aren't there lots of, like, human rights abuses for, like, the manufacturing of iPhones? And didn't they put up suicide nets? Like, that's Foxconn. Like, they're a Taiwanese company in which a lot of their manufacturing is based out of China, and they make all sorts of money and have been historically known for having all sorts of labor disputes, labor abuses, awful labor practices in their manufacturing facilities, especially in China. And this was part of an effort to bring Foxconn to build a sort of state-of-the-art manufacturing facility that was supposed to provide 13,000, quote, good-paying jobs by 2022. And this is in a state among, you know, lots of states in the Midwest in which the outsourcing of manufacturing has really hurt a lot of an aging population in which that's all they are known. And so just gonna rattle off this part comes from a Bloomberg article from a couple weeks back called Inside Wisconsin's Disastrous $4.5 Billion Deal with Foxconn. And then we'll touch on a separate piece from Reply All in a minute that's more the human side of all this. But if everything went as planned, Wisconsin would be would finally stop paying for this, be out of the red in 2042. The tax revenue projections for this deal presume everyone will live in Wisconsin, despite the fact that the town everything's going to be built in, Mount Pleasant, is 20 minutes from the Illinois border, and it is extremely common for people to live in Illinois and work in Wisconsin, and often vice versa. It was pitched to Wisconsin, apparently, as becoming the state's own Wisconn Valley. Like, that was part of Foxconn's pitch. Like, oh, it's Silicon Valley, Wisconn.
Wisconn Valley.
Yeah. No, honestly, anything you come up with probably better than Wisconn. I wish I could have been in the meeting where that was actually said out loud and someone, like, put their arms up in a fist, like, yeah.
I got it.
Foxconn also, like, as a company, has, like, a long history of taking subsidies and sort of, like, running off. They've done this not just this is, the biggest boondoggle in the United States, but they've done it in Brazil and India and all over the place. They're just kind of well known for being a multi-billion-dollar manufacturing company that then suddenly places that want those quote unquote capital J jobs, they end up, like, just running over themselves to offer Foxconn anything. And so this was part of basically supposed to be like the pin in Scott Walker, a notorious anti-labor union busting, enormous piece of shit governor in the great state of Wisconsin, who was thankfully voted out in the midterm election. This was supposed to be sort of like part of his, like, big, like, this is why you should elect me to a third term. And in the months and years since this was signed in late 2017, in August 2018, Foxconn said the factory would go from a 75-25 split of assembly line workers versus engineering workers to a 10-90 split, in which it would then be just 10% assembly line and 90% engineering workers, which Foxconn actually liked to call knowledge workers, please. Not engineers, workers. And in January 2019, Foxconn missed its hiring quota by 82%, which means it didn't qualify for the tax rebates, but there are still all sorts of problems.
I prefer to think of it meeting their quota by almost 20. But that's just fair. That's how I look at things, because, you know, I'm pro-business, pro-growth.
We all want jobs, Rob, right? And so, I mean, that's ultimately, like, you could go read this piece. There are a billion other things I could pull out that'll make you tear your hair out. The fact that after Scott Walker lost his gubernatorial bid, that the legislator passed laws so that the new Democratic governor couldn't rip up this deal because the town of Mount Pleasant had already invested $120 million, because the state of Wisconsin had already invested like $80 million, and they just wanted this deal to go through. And it's just the Bloomberg piece is a really stark look at, like, the high level of how these deals are made, about the myth that politicians sell on, this is how we get jobs, this is how we save the great American worker, this is how we bring manufacturing back. They're just selling packs of lies, throwing money into a check that will hopefully get them reelected. And then even when they get the boot, someone else, probably a Democrat, is going to have to deal with it. And the other piece of this, which I'm going to tee up for Rob because he like just finished listening to it and getting infuriated, is there's a Reply All podcast called Negative Mount Pleasant. And Mount Pleasant's the town in which this was all supposed to be built. That is very much about the human side of like the Bloomer piece is more about like technocrats and the politicians and how they get sold into suckered really into giving away this kind of money. Although suckered maybe
suckered's too strong. Like
that's too strong that's, because it's their it world. Presumes that they didn't they didn't know what they were getting into.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the high level, this is not about people being suckered. Like Scott Walker in Wisconsin were not suckered into doing this.
So Scott
like,
Walker
this
is a very smart, cunning individual who knew what he was doing when he was trying to destroy things like unions.
Yeah,
especially
exactly.
Public
well,
unions.
He's cunning. Yes. Is the right? Yeah, I don't know how like actually smart he is, but he definitely like it knows how to achieve desired ends.
Sure.
Yes. So, but as far as people actually getting conned. I think this Reply All episode is really fascinating because it does sort of hit that where the rubber meets the road level of deals like this. A lot of times they get discussed in these really like abstract and hard to follow terms. Like how Wisconsin structures a deal like this is both by necessity and somewhat by design opaque. So much of it is about like tax rebates, tax credits, tax
meeting
breaks.
Quotas,
like,
hiring quotas.
Yeah.
Like what is that? What is that? Like you see... You read an article in your local paper, it's like, they missed their hiring quota, and so they won't get the tax rebate. And maybe in your head you go, all right, well, the system's working. They're not getting the money. Like, oh, okay. Like, maybe this is, I mean, it's just easy to see on a day-to-day basis.
But you don't know
how
the rest of the deal is structured, how that, right. Like, what the actual bottom line figures are going to be. You don't know necessarily how much the state is actually spending to make a deal like this happen versus how much it is simply agreeing not to tax. These things are hard to track. What you see in the Reply All episode is what it looks like when a deal like this comes to town, basically. What happens to a community that finds itself in the middle of a policy initiative like this. And it's really kind of shocking and upsetting because the place it covers, Mount Pleasant, is kind of your quintessential Midwestern small town. Mm-hmm. They have a colorful cast of characters at their regular town halls. Their town halls are all very, like, what you think of as very small town America, right? Discuss updates from council members and citizens about how the softball league is doing. You know, things like that.
Who always has to come to the town hall to complain about something.
Well, right. And the story kind of centers her as she's like the local shit stirrer. But then all those dynamics are kind of kicked into overdrive when this Foxconn deal starts to become a possibility. And suddenly this town council, which had been a little bit somewhat accused of like being self-dealing and a little bit, you know, self-serving with regard to how civil servants were rewarded at the expense of taxpayer dollars. Mm-hmm. All these dynamics get amplified in the Foxconn deal. And you see how this little town council kind of become the frontline muscle for Foxconn and the Republican Party trying to push this deal through, whether and not only like whether or not people in Mount Pleasant want it. The point is that people in Mount Pleasant are never given the chance to figure out whether they want it. The entire thing happens basically behind closed doors. And because these meetings are public, there's records, there's these really dramatic recordings of the moments where the town council's like, okay, we're going to talk about a thing, we're moving into closed session, and they kick everybody out. And so it's a really, like, it starts as a really cute episode in some ways. Like, you'd expect it in almost a comedy. But then it starts getting really dark as the stakes of this become clear and the consequences for people in that community become clear.
Yeah, it's the difference between, like, it's local journalism. And it's done by Reply All, but it's, like, the idea of, like, grounding what's happening in the trenches with deals like this, like when you hear some people had to move out of their homes, like, oh, well, they have to be compensated, right? Like, that's Like, that's how that works, right? Like, they get some money, and probably in your head you think, like, well, if they're taking out their homes, they're getting a fair shake. They're going to be able to go get another, like, they'll go figure that out. And, like, I seem to remember, like, one of the, like, most heartbreaking stories in that Reply All piece is somebody who more or less gets conned out of an, caught in the bureaucratic grind in which they never get
their... actually even worse. So the issue is that one of the people in the town is giving people money to move out of their homes to make room for this massive Foxconn facility. And they decide they're going to give this money per household, not per person relocated. Right. And yes. then suddenly yes. it's not yes. that much money, right? Like, then they're giving you like $20,000 per household to move. One of the people caught up in this is a disabled person who had a home set up to be compatible and livable for a person with their health issues. That's expensive. Customizing a home that way is expensive, and it requires you know, a lot of work. This has been their home for years and years. And they're just moved out and sent to a place that, first, the new places are basically dumps. And second, it's sure as hell not, you know, it's sure as hell not an accessible home. And so this person is going to, is at the council, and they start breaking down in tears, like asking, what did I do to you? Like, I'm sorry. Like, I'm sorry to my family. I'm sorry to whoever I pissed off on this council. I don't know why you're doing this. And it's just, it's gut-wrenching. It is one of, it's excruciating here.
Are the houses that they're being moved into, like, housing specifically built to replace the homes that are being, you know, torn down?
No, it sounds like, so it's so like Mount
just
Pleasant.
Like, it's like just like cert, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Like scouted houses that are available in another area.
Yeah, that's how it sounds. It also sounds like Mount Pleasant had some unused housing inventory, i.e. places that were foreclosed on and abandoned, that maybe were, like, people were just kind of being moved into whatever housing was available. Mm-hmm. And so it was a real crapshoot as to what quality of home you were getting. But what you were not getting was something equivalent to, like, this is the awful thing. Like, if I lost my apartment tomorrow, if my apartment burned down, the cash value I'd get for that would not be near the value of, like, what it costs to recreate your home, right? Like, yeah, the things you actually have and need. That this is that, like, times 100. Here's the other thing they were doing. The reason these people weren't given a choice about whether they were moving is not because they were being offered, like, fair value for their property. Mount Pleasant was declaring their entire part of the town blighted and that they were being moved for health and safety reasons, which changes the dynamics of, like, what you have to offer people, right? If you're offering people, like, you... If you're moving people out of their home,
like you're building a highway or something like that,
you have to offer some kind of fair value for that.
Mm-hmm.
If you declare that their home is basically a toxic waste dump,
yeah,
then you don't. And that's what Mount Pleasant did. And so after hearing this guy plead to be allowed to stay in his home, the board just voted, you know, fuck it. That entire district is blighted. Everyone has to move and take this cash value we're offering. No modifications. Like, it's awful.
God.
Yeah. It's and that's why I think, like, these two pair together really well, because, like, it's given, like, the state, like, that's why the Amazon thing is noteworthy, right? Like, this was, I mean, it's even reasonable to expect that, you know, Amazon could get a sweetheart deal from another city. That, you know, the idea of corporate welfare is not going to stop here, but it is, like, well worth understanding both how it works on, like, a higher political level and, like, mm-hmm. how that plays out, but then also remembering, because what it's so easy to forget is, like, what does this actually mean for, like, the people on the ground that would have been impacted, right? And, like, that's part of, like, the Amazon thing is, like, well, what would have happened to the people in those neighborhoods that, like, suddenly are gentrified as a result of Amazon coming in? It's different than them, their houses being blighted by a city council, and then, but, like, it's still, like, the removal of people's homes, their lives, and it's just hard to imagine. Like, it's just, like, there's this quote that, like, I couldn't from the Bloomberg piece where Wisconsin officials apparently didn't consider Gao, who is a sort of a right hand man for sort of like the chief executive at Foxconn. Wisconsin officials apparently didn't consider Gao's track record problematic. Instead, they described the billionaire who charmed them with stories of his early days selling TV parts in the Midwest as almost philanthropic. Quote, my impression of him was, what a nice person, said Scott Neitzel, who led negotiations for the Walker administration. Quote, an extremely genuine, down-to-earth tycoon.
Okay, wait.
When asked if the state, when asked if the state looked at Foxconn's history, WEDC Chief Executive Officer Mark Hogan, which is related, is kind of an economic council in Wisconsin. Mark Hogan says, quote, we didn't spend a lot of time on that because in the end, we got to know these people so well.
My favorite roller coaster tycoon achievement is down to earth tycoon. You know, when you just keep it real for everybody in the park, you know.
I thought that was the chivo you got when your coaster killed like 100 people in one ride when it smacked. Like, I thought that was the,
down
to earth. Yeah. I mean, that's unreal. There's another incredible line where the town council president from Mount Pleasant, Dave DeGroot, says after this fact-finding mission to a factory in Asia, he comes back and he's talking to the Reply All journalist. And he says, I've seen the future, and it's coming to Mount Pleasant. And literally, the thing that I flash back to is the podcast Limetown, which is about an entire, like, town that is built and taken over for the service of, like, this massive, weapons research conglomerate. Like, literally, the pins they hand out to everybody is at that town, where everyone is eventually killed, is I have seen the future. And then it's got like a town seal on it. And I just flash back to that because like this is kind of the creepy dystopia we're creeping towards. But also, I was really kind of stunned by the degree to which you see how in the face of this money and influence from Foxconn, you see how this group of what you consider like kind of harmless town bureaucrats really kind of embrace an authoritarian impulse. And this like shouldn't surprise anyone who's ever like dealt with, I mean, shit, you want to see like petty authoritarians, like, you know, attend a condo board meeting, stuff like that. Right. Like any sort of group of people, there's going to be like everyday people who like love the little taste of power they get and the ability to like run roughshod over people. But to like see that happen at the Mount Pleasant Town Council, and to see this guy who seemed like maybe a bit full of himself, but fundamentally harmless, to see him do this heel turn and basically turn into this like megalomaniac during a town council meeting and start like telling people he's going to find them out of order and have the sheriff throw them out. It is so creepy because I think this is when we look at this from the high level, like in the Bloomberg story, it's all these opaque numbers. Right. It's a policy initiative. It's hard to track. Like, how does this like what's happening here? Is it an effective policy? Is this a good way to raise jobs? Which are important questions. But at the ground level, you realize to make a deal like this happen, there are people who have to be moved out of the way. There are people who need to stop raising objections. There are a lot of things that need to get done. And there to actually discuss them would be to stop them. Right. To give people a chance to find out what is going to happen would blow up the deal. And so you need, you know, your neighbor next door, your town councilman, you need those people to basically become the enforcers for an initiative like that. And that's the thing I found like really kind of haunting about this is Foxconn came to town and whatever happens with this factory, that town is not going to be the same. The civic like fabric of that town is forever altered by what people did around this.
Yeah, that makes me think a lot about like what actions can we take to actually like as citizens to prevent these sort of things from happening. And I think a lot about like how Amazon didn't happen. Amazon New York City HQ did not happen. And like, is it from like the amount of like organizers that, you know, like rallied against in the protests that were being done, you know, on Wall Street? Or like it's like I guess this is like I'm more posing this as a question rather than sort of my own thought, But like, how much say, like, in an example like Mount Pleasant, like there was no conference between the citizens and the like politicians making deals with the corporation itself. So when it comes to like New York City, like, is it just that we have, like, I don't know. I'm kind of just like, how did we get ourselves out of this? And like, what makes other smaller towns like incapable of, I don't want to say incapable, but what prevents them?
They don't have a Twitter mob. You know, I mean, I think they're like, part of it, the Amazon thing cannot be disconnected from the amount of uproar there was on and constantly over social media over that specific deal. And that also cannot be disconnected from the disproportionate amount of reporters and media critics who are then also located in New York. Mm-hmm. So there was also like something very specific about the Amazon deal in which you don't see that sort of concentrated uproar in other, I mean, because it's natural, right? You're going to claw back at something that's in your own backyard a little harder and with more anger than something that's down the, you know, across the country. Mm-hmm. But I think that is, like, it's both hopeful what happened to Amazon, but it also, like, is worth remembering, like, how hyper-specific the local and even, like, regional and national politics are about, like, what's happening
in New York
in that
City.
Region that is different than, you know, Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin, which, like, again, as someone that spends a lot of time in areas like that, you know, what you get is like a big picture Bloomberg. You're lucky if you get a reply all, because that at least puts a human face to what's going on here. Mm-hmm. But I think, I mean, it requires a cultural shift where, you know, politicians are put into place that are, like, specifically are against culture warfare or corporate welfare in order to solve these problems. But also it's like a larger indictment of where the United States is, you know, societally anyway, because part of the reason these deals get accepted is because the politician can credibly say, like, what the fuck else do you expect us to do?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a failure of generationally of not having an answer for, like, what do you do for these displaced manufacturing towns? And, like, I go through them all the time and it's like, yeah, you go through whole fucking blocks. Not a single person living in those homes. And this isn't because it was the 2008 bubble. This is because this is the slow erosion of these smaller towns where there is just nothing else. Or if they're in those houses, man, how is someone living in that house? But, you know, what's the other option? Like, it's heartbreaking. But also, you can see how even local people would say, well, yeah, that doesn't sound that great. But, I mean, a job is good.
Right.
And then, well, and because they're not going to, like, it's very, politicians of just about every stripe, but particularly GOP politicians, are very comfortable at the rhetoric of, we will spend whatever it takes, we will defer taxes on whatever it takes in order to create some number of jobs in the distance. But the government has to be like, pardon?
But these jobs aren't even for, like, this is the part that gets me, is like, the jobs that we're going to be, like, predominant, the majority of jobs at Amazon HQ were not going to serve the Long Island City population. Like, mm-hmm. those were all fucking, like, tech engineer jobs, like, upwards of over 100K a year, like sophisticated software engineer careers. And in Mount Pleasant, like, you saw the swap from, you know, the
75-25 to 90-10. Yeah. And there was even the
and the interns,
the engineer, even the engineers they were going to hire. They eventually, Foxconn noted, they were going to start shipping in folks from China to be the engineers. And then there's a line in the piece where the Wisconsin, like, bureaucrats, like, figure out, like, well, shit, like, I thought that wasn't going to happen. And then they realized they didn't put it in writing that Foxconn just said they were going to not do that.
Right.
But there was nothing to prevent them from doing that. Largely that stuff comes from because, well, if you put that in the writing, then Foxconn is going to say no, and they're going to go somewhere else. So,
right. And the fact that, like, they couldn't maintain interns at the Foxconn Corporation. Yeah. Like they filled like many of their like positions with interns, and then like just here it is. Only about 60 people working there, abruptly called about 15 of them, all interns, into a room to say they should seek other jobs because there wasn't enough work to hire them full time. And this is supposed to be a factory that's sustaining like an entire town. Like this, it like that's what's like so bonkers to me is just where like the actual math and what you're advocating for, which is the people of the town itself, the people of Long Island City, the people of Mount Pleasant, bringing them careers, and then that just being like a fucking lie. Like that, it's just there's like I don't see what's the other way around it. Like unless like Amazon is like inexcusable because there's no way that you can say that those jobs, like I don't know, those jobs were always going to be those jobs. And it seems like here in like the Foxconn, there was like a switch up, and that there was like things not written in it. There was not, you know, things in writing that could have prevented this and things like that. That they were like kind of getting things like the rug pulled out from underneath them.
But there it was a case of these are things that should have been foreseeable, right? This is the other part of
well, yeah, they could have been prevented by just like doing due diligence, right? Like yeah. by putting like in writing the protections and things that you like.
Well, there's this great moment where like the Foxconn negotiator, like there's text that Bloomberg saw where he's texting with some Economic Development Council people.
Love to text.
And he's texting with them and says, give me $200 million and this deal is a go right now. And it's amazing because it lets you know what the Foxconn negotiators thought of the people they were dealing with. That is the most shoot your shot like text to send in the middle of a negotiation around this. Like, hey, you give me $200 million cash up front. We will close this deal right now. It is,
and also presumably that's worked before, right?
Yeah.
Like you don't shoot that shot unless like some other small time, you know, city council person, whether in the United States or somewhere else in their equivalent position, like said, yeah, of course. Like, yes. Well, yeah, let's do it. Let's sign the deal. This was another fucking quote. Following a similar playbook as it did in India and Brazil, the Foxconn in August announced a $100 million joint venture fund and said it's building R&D centers around Wisconsin, including Green Bay. Nobody has cogently explained what these centers will do. One person familiar with the plans calls them glorified think tanks. Foxconn says they'll, quote, one of my favorite lines of corporate gibberish, cultivate a new class of vertical solution providers. Like, what the fuck does that even mean? But you know what? Like, that stuff, words like that gives you a window into how you arrive at like the quote I read earlier of someone like, well, we didn't look into it that much because you see enough buzzwords, you go on enough fancy dinners, mm-hmm. they fly you to China to look at a manufacturing plant, and you get promised a photo op with President Trump, and like you see how
with a gold
not
shovel.
That this is excusable, but you just see how it happens.
Yeah.
And clearly Foxconn is very good at this because they continue to be able to pull it off over and over again because there are not solutions, ideas to even provide as an alternative because there's nothing to run against. It's just someone says, we'll fix it. And even if they end up breaking everything in the process, you know, the government of Wisconsin, you know, partially fueled by, you know, 8+ years of Scott Walker trying to bust up everything the government does anyway, doesn't have another option to provide. And even then ties the hands of the Democrats when they come in to try and fix this thing. Like, it's a long con by the Republicans, honestly, where like they know the Foxconn thing is fucked, but you know what's clever is if they can't rip up the deal, that is going to taint all 6 years of the Democratic governor, where in 6 years, boy, the Republicans can come in and say, you know, they really fucked up this whole Foxconn thing. And no one's going to remember that they had passed any legislation saying that they tied the hands of the Democratic governor.
There's two other things to bear in mind here. One is that these are being often it's portrayed as like as if providing these breaks, these incentives is some kind of neutral thing to spur growth and create jobs.
Yeah, this is a good
point. What gets overlooked in that is other firms competing in this space that are already established, that already run manufacturing facilities, do not get these tax breaks. They do. This was the issue with Amazon too, right? Like, a lot of the retail businesses that Amazon competes with are doing things like, I don't know, paying full-time employees, paying taxes in a shit ton of different municipalities.
Giving their workers fucking lunch breaks.
Yeah, ideally, like certainly like at least not hitting the same like incredible lows of working in an Amazon fulfillment center. Mm-hmm. But Amazon comes on because they're the new hotness. They're coming in and everywhere they go, they're demanding these almost extortionate tax breaks and tax credits that the places they compete with can't get. Nobody was going to blow the budget up to get a new Sears office building or something like built somewhere. Like that never happened.
You can drop the almost. Like it is extortion of like local governments that don't have other options.
And so this was the issue with like Amazon. The other part of this was you were going to have the government basically massively reduce the overhead that Amazon has to pay on operating, which will give it a massive competitive advantage to established firms that probably provide, that probably in a lot of cases provide more jobs, better jobs to more people. You are helping Amazon undercut those folks and drive them out of business. That's just, that is what is happening in a case like this. And that's what's happening to a degree with a place like Foxconn, right? Like, Foxconn is coming in, and almost certainly one reason you were pushing for incentives like this is so that, again, you can offer lower rates, lower costs to places like Apple and get goods produced cheaper rather than pay an established manufacturing company that might have higher obligations to workers, to pensions, stuff like that. These things are not neutral. These are not jobs from thin air. There is an element of cannibalization inherent in a lot of deals like this, and presenting it as these are all these gee whiz new companies with these brilliant new ideas. Their brilliant new idea is this extortion in a lot of cases. Their brilliant new idea is getting these sort of sweetheart packages that allow them to just slowly run their opposition into the ground.
Mm-hmm. And it's not the only version of this, right? Like we see this all the time with sports teams. Like this is just a different form. This is like in which what's dangled over people's heads, politicians' heads, is the potential for jobs. But for decades, like billionaires have been subsidizing the development of new stadiums in service of fandom. Well, we'll take your team away unless you let us build a new site, and you subsidize half, three quarters, most of it. And it's like only recently in the last 5 years that we've seen some cities tell billionaires to fuck off, like find another way to do it. And like this is all part of the same mindset, like the same psychology of extorting folks like by dangling something over their head, whether it's fandom or whether it's a job. But like it's not a coincidence that both of those things are like deeply psychologically important to people in different ways. Like whatever you think of fandom and sports fandom, like it in a lot of places, especially, you know, places like the Midwest, like deeply ingrained in culture and like community. And like, that's what jobs are too. And like, that's how you can get away with shit like this, is because like on the promise of taking away something or giving you something that means a lot to you and potentially your family. Mm.
And last thing I'll say is like, we will bend over backwards to funnel money into operations like this rather than provide any direct aid or benefit to people who are struggling to make ends meet, to people whose jobs have been eliminated by offshoring, things like that. Providing actual, like putting like cash in people's pockets and helping them directly and injecting money directly into communities. Well, that's, you know, that's not rewarding people for hard work, right? That's creating a culture of dependence. But if you hand this money to, you know, multi-billion dollar companies, that is job creation. That is all to the good. That is the virtuous American way. And that is kind of where a lot of our political rhetoric is. And I think one reason why this like fell apart in New York is that at least in New York, in addition to all the media attention, you do have like, you have some establishment left, but you also have a growing sort of, you know, radical left that is, that doesn't buy into that rhetoric, that that sort of contests the very premises of these arguments. And so there were people in New York that once they started to sour on the deal, once they started to realize their supporters were souring on the deal, there was political action that could happen that could derail this. I'm not
also
sure.
It suggests like actually these arguments are easier to defeat than we think, and that we know that the arguments for them are paper fucking thin.
Yeah.
And that New York and Amazon and, you know, looking at the boondoggle that is Foxconn, like, provides like a rhetorical and a political path forward, hopefully, for other activists in their local areas to push back on similar proposals.
Wisconsin by design also has a less representative legislature. That's the other, right. That's the other part I was going to getting at with this is there's also an element of Scott Walker had years to create a legislature that reflected his values and priorities. Mm. And so when you have a deal like this begin to, you know, turn rotten and you have people realizing how they've been taken, what you've got are Scott Walkers and Dave DeGroots all the way down, right? That's who you can appeal to say, can you fix this? Can you stop this? And in Wisconsin, you've got a bunch of people who actively don't want to help you, who actively want to see deals like this get done, who want to make sure that, who view it as their job to deliver distressed communities and workers into the hands of massive corporations. That's their worldview. That's how they see their job in government. I think that's the other key difference, and that's one of the dynamics that we really need to see the change over the coming election cycles. Anyway, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to dig into another fascinating report, this time from ProPublica, about the crash of the crash of the USS Fitzgerald.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
All right, and we're back. So,
time for something way less distressing.
Yeah, another cheery pick me up.
Oh, this fucking article, y'all, fucked me up so much.
I took no notes because I was too fixated on reading the goddamn thing.
I felt like I was watching a fucking movie.
I always have my notebook out. I'm ready to like jot down things, pull quotes. I got through the opening. Like six paragraphs, put my notebook aside. It was just like, okay, you have my attention.
I felt like
let's
I was
go.
Watching a movie in which Tom Hanks is there and is trying to save a naval ship because that's a movie that's been done before. But, this really fucked me up. Like, all seriousness.
It really does read like a peacetime Crimson Tide or something like that. So what we're talking about is a story called Fight the Ship, which is a ProPublica report by T. Christian Miller, Megan Rose, and Robert Fudaraki on the collision of the USS Fitzgerald and how it revealed some major issues with the U.S. Navy. And some background on this is you might remember in 2017 there were two separate incidents in which U.S. Navy destroyers collided with cargo ships in the Pacific. And both of those incidents involved a significant number of fatalities aboard both ships. And it was a scandal that had people sort of questioning what the hell was happening in the U.S. Pacific fleet and resulted in some commanders getting cashiered. Mm-hmm. So the specific story we're talking about covers the June 17th collision of the USS Fitzgerald with a cargo ship just off the coast of Japan. And the background here, there's a lot of things that are distressing about this, but one of the things that is really eyebrow-raising with a story like this is the USS Fitzgerald is right now sort of the top of the line Arleigh Burke class U.S. destroyer. Now, that destroyer class is in the process of being replaced, but nevertheless, right now, these are, theoretically at least, the most advanced destroyers the U.S. Navy fields. And both ships were part of the United States 7th Fleet, which is kind of arguably maybe regarded as like the most elite and important fleet in the U.S. Navy. This is a fleet that whose record goes back to World War II. So this was kind of a really shocking set of incidents. And this one was particularly shocking because here you have, like, again, theoretically, you should have the best ships with the best equipment in the best and most prestigious fleet in the Navy, and both have these two disasters in short succession, both involving your destroyer just fucking walking into the path of a container ship. So how does that happen? And this story is, I think, really fascinating because, one, it tells a really tense and, like, compelling human story. Like, it puts you
right
on this
in
fucking
there.
Ship.
Like, it feels like, that's what I meant when I said it feels like you're watching a movie, because the play by play is, like, down to such a, like, minute detail. And also, like, the packaging of the article itself, like, it's so evocative. It's like one of the—
You want to describe that a little bit?
Yeah, the way that the article, it's like there's like, not quick time, but there's while you're scrolling through, scrolling down through the article, there's like visuals in the background that are being like played on loop, and depending on what section you're in, like there's one section where, at the top you see the actual path of the two ships as you're scrolling, like in real time, as you like move, they cross with each other, and you see, like, it pinpoints exactly how many degrees, like, the ACX Crystal, which was the cargo ship, like, pushed the USS Fitzgerald, like, into, and it's, like, for someone who doesn't, like, understand knots and degrees and, like, other maritime, like, description, or I don't know if that's the right word, but other, like, boat descriptions, I don't know.
Yeah. Like, yeah, there's like a, there's
what's
a
great
of
is you had the right word, by
I
the
did?
Way. Like,
okay.
Maritime, and you're like, nah, boat.
Well, I wasn't sure.
But I mean, like, what you described is like, it, you've seen those words, you think you know what they mean, you have like some kind of context for them, but you don't actually know how they all connect.
Right.
And it's like right in the middle of the paragraph where your brain is trying
to figure it
to
out,
build a
yeah.
mental map of what it's saying, it actually just shows you what it is.
Yeah.
So that immediately you're able to take the written word and then just apply it to a visual that is like very evocative of what it just described in a way that's like a 1-2
yeah
punch.
Exactly. And there, and then it also has, you know, like artwork that's, you know, very emotionally devastating, of you know, painting portraits of some of the people that were on the ship. It has boat paths, maritime paths. No, that's not it. It has the route, the boat route.
There you
the
go.
The USS
nailed
Fitzgerald
it.
Route is there. And this the pacing of, you know, of the article itself, in the way that it jumps from, you know, context to like moment by moment what went down, like as the crash happened and in the moments just after, was just like incredible to me. Like, this was such a riveting experience, like reading experience. So it was just extremely impressive. I'm not like super familiar with ProPublica in the first place, so seeing an article like this packaged this way was fascinating and really helped me like paint the picture of what went down in my head. And it is just like absolutely devastating. The fact that the thing that got me the sort of not the most, I mean, there's so much in this that is just like so fucked up. But this happened at 1:30 in the morning. And to the end of their training that day was like 11 p.m. And I was thinking, like, what time would I expect like disaster to strike? In like I would say like 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning, like sometime that like you just the fact that like 1:30 in the morning is like is a time that like doesn't seem that far away from, I don't know, like normal, like, I don't want to say normal hours, because obviously like everything that takes place on the ship is like operating on a completely different time schedule from like our normal, from like my like day to day. But that is just like, it's so terrifying that is the level of like so much of, I mean, there's so many things to attribute to what went wrong here, but thinking about like the exhaustion of inexperience, like this, the piece opens up by saying, you know, it's the dead of the night and the USS Fitzgerald is on a secret mission to the South China Sea. The sailors on the $1.8 billion destroyer are young, tired, and poorly trained. Disaster strikes at 1:30, 34 a.m. Like that, like the amount, oh God, the amount of exhaustion that like that training ends at 11 p.m. and just 2 hours later is how long it takes for like just that exhaustion to fully kick in and you know what I'm, do you know what I'm trying to say?
Well, like I mean, the other thing is the training had wrapped up at 11. I think the ship had basically been underway since like 6 in the morning.
Yeah.
The people who were watching the ship at this point, a lot of them, a number of them had put in, had had like 1 or 1.5 hours of sleep in the past 24.
Right.
Like that was
right.
How people were operating. And so it's not, you would think in normal circumstances, like, okay, like maybe something like this would happen in the very
dead, you know, of the night.
Like, like just before dawn. Yeah. Right. But no, this happens basically within a couple hours of the ship going into night travel mode.
Yeah.
Right. Of the crew concluding their drills and heading to bed. And almost immediately, like the minute that happens, the minute the ship sort of stands down for the evening,
yeah,
is when the danger just spikes.
Yeah.
Because what the people who are left doing their job are just mind-numbingly exhausted. And then the other issue is, do they actually know how to do their jobs?
Right.
Do they know how to do all the jobs they are asked to do in the process of keeping a watch like this? Mm-hmm. And that's the really, that's the other really unsettling part like this. The picture that's painted in this piece is that ships like the USS Fitzgerald are kind of paper tigers, right? You can say it's a $1.8 billion warship, but what it describes over the course of this article is basically something that's, you know, just holding on by the slenderest of threads, right? You've got a crew that has not had time to train. There are not enough crew. And a number of the officers and a number of the officers aren't really well trained on their specific equipment as well.
There's a specific quote that I think is like super telling here, where the article reads, "Its radars were in questionable shape, and it's not clear the crew knew how to operate them. One could not be made to automatically track nearby ships. To keep the screen updated, a sailor had to punch a button 1,000 times an hour. The ship's primary navigation system was run by 17-year-old software." Like,
yeah. Well, and so this is such an interesting story, because I think this is also one of those stories where, with all the things that are fucked up in the U.S. right now and the way our government has operated for you know, the past decade, you would think, well, shit, like we spend an unbelievable amount on defense spending, right? If there's one aspect of the U.S. government spending that is probably going to be, you know, a tight ship, right? If you expect one thing to be working really, really well, you would expect it to be the Navy, right? You would expect, with all the money that's gone into that, you would expect the military would at least be well taken care of, even if social services are, you know, falling into ruin and being cut right and left. You know, domestically, you would expect the military, which has been, you know, getting pretty uncontroversial massive spending increases pushed to it over the years, you'd expect they'd be doing all right and they would not be facing sort of infrastructural decay.
Especially
and yet what this story paints is a picture of, oh yeah, the rod is hitting there too, and it's way worse than you think.
Right. Especially because the Navy is like, as it's sort of painted in this article, supposed to be the first line of defense against like our current biggest threat, which is like nuclear warfare, I guess. Like, the Navy is right now like the number one thing like protecting us from like offshore threats from like North Korea. They talk about like a more aggressive Russia and things like that. And so like it seems like the Navy, especially with like Trump's fucking rhetoric around like who our biggest enemies are right now, like it seems like the Navy would be the number one, like most concentrated, like most attended to faction of like the US military itself, because of everything, because of like the context in which like I understand like Trump's position towards like military, why we're spending so much on the military and what his ideas of our biggest threats to be. And the fact that like this, the commander of the ship specifically, like this ship was like being sent out understaffed, and mm-hmm. this ship was being sent out like having not passed, like I think it's 22 different requirements that it has to pass in order to like be deemed not safe to fully battle ready. Exactly. Yeah. It had passed 7 of them, and it had left port to go on like a trial mission at first.
Sort of showing the flag in the South China Sea. And basically that's what it was being asked to do.
But it never returned back, right? So it just like kept being sent, like it just kept going. It was like supposed to return much earlier.
So it had just left port. It was just being sent out on this new mission. The issue is that that ship, like a lot of other ships, kept being sent out on these missions it was like, oh, tensions are high with North Korea right now.
Right.
We're going to send a carrier battle group to like sail near Korea just as a show of force. And ships like this were detailed to do that. And every minute you got a ship out on the high seas is a minute the ship is not undergoing maintenance and repair.
Right,
and the problem
is
all these ships are way behind on that.
Right, right, right.
The other thing that's really kind of astonishing here is, so the other thing to bear in mind is that things like this happen over a term of years. Like naval warships tend to have like operational lives of like 30 years, if not longer. So like things operate across multiple administrations. There's a second part of this article that covers just what's been happening in the Navy, basically since the early 2000s, starting with the first Bush administration, then through the Obama years, and now into the present day, where just bit by bit, the Navy has been kind of robbing Peter to pay Paul with a lot of this stuff. And now we are at the point where you can't do that. Trick is not working anymore. The costs have added up and become way too dangerous. And now what was sort of a series of like minor problems maybe 10 years ago is starting to hit the crisis point. That's mm-hmm. the other thing this article is starting to get at.
Yeah.
I'm reminded, this is a side, a shout out that Danielle Reno and I did a podcast about Sunshine. Recently, and my favorite moment in that movie is there's a moment where when they're on the ship and the chief like scientist, like whoever does all the calculations for the ship and when it needs to change direction, makes a mistake, and that mistake leads to a lot of deaths and really a lot of the errors that befall the rest of that film. And there's like a shot where the camera pans over at Tim and he is just screaming fuck, 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 because he messed up. Like he made a mistake and he made a human error. And like some of my favorite stories, some of the ones I find the most compelling, are people who psychologically we are built up to be superhuman. Like the kind of people that are like, you know, you hear terms like corporal and like all the fancy terms that go in the military. And in our minds, like they are built up to be like more than they're the best of us. Like they aren't capable of making these mistakes. Mm-hmm. And I think part of what I find so compelling in this piece is like the moments where it finds times like to visit those people and sit in those moments. It both explains how they came to make those mistakes, what they did in the moment, how they tried to explain how that mistake occurred, and like really ruminates in those moments to like put you, even though the article largely concludes with very convincing evidence that they were hit on both sides, really, like they weren't prepared, but also like the bureaucracy and the structure led them to failure. But it doesn't like lose the human part of that in the process. It like sits in, what is it like to know that a mistake you made, regardless of how it happened, like led to the deaths of 7 people? And like those are the most haunting passages in the whole piece, where it like really, like I think there's a sequence where like they all start to kind of gather up on the ship and they're trying to assess the damage, and one of the main folks like is just found sobbing uncontrollably. I think it was one of the there were so many names I found trouble to keep track of everybody, but you know, where someone like realizing the gravity of the mistake they have made is like now incapable of doing their job despite all of the training they have spent thousands of hours building to moments like this. Like they are unable to do what they are then asked to do, and others have to step up. And like, I think the article, like despite being like a story about like a bureaucratic nightmare and how that leads to systemic failure, also is like deeply human in a way that like I found to be remarkable.
Yeah, it's just an incredible report, because like it is such a thorough going over of the situation, and it is amazing when you do see like the person who was the officer on deck when the collision happened. She does break down and basically cannot function during the crisis because the magnitude of what has happened and what she arguably helped cause. It's just hit home, and it's too much to bear. Like how do you bear that? But then you also see, some aspects of this is the danger, right? The other issue here is that the Navy has this culture of you do the mission. It does not matter how fucked things are. You fulfill your mission. You have to do the job with what you have available. And the problem is, institutionally, the Navy has relied on that to paper over all these bureaucratic fuck-ups that have been mounting for years, right? Just figure it out. Look, we get that your crews are undertrained. We get that the equipment is starting to break down. You're a naval officer. Go figure your shit out. Get the mission done. And that is how you set up people for a disaster like this, right? Because there's going to be a moment where that can-do spirit just can't do it anymore, right? You're playing Russian roulette at that point. But you also see people like there's this one woman, Lieutenant Stephanie Bro, who takes over the damage control responsibility during this crisis. And she's sitting there doing equations, on a scratch pad, basically figuring out like, okay, what's the rate at which the ship is flooding? Where is it flooding?
Even fucking imagine?
She's realizing she needs to flood other parts of the ship to balance out the flooding so the ship doesn't capsize, but then there are other risks. How's that going to change its role? And she basically takes over this effort and starts stabilizing a situation where, like, this ship was in grave danger of sinking. And just through, like, you know, sheer skill at this aspect of her job and ability to take control of the situation and get everyone pointed in the same direction, you know, she's one of the people that like saves the ship, right? You've got the only surviving helmsman aboard the ship basically has to go back to the auxiliary helm, which is basically at the stern of the ship and not at the bridge. And the intercom stops working because things are all fucked aboard the ship and it's flooded. So they can't actually talk to the person steering the ship in the internal ship communication. And so they have to rig up like a game of telephone between the commanders on the bridge down to this helmsman in the back of the ship, steering the ship, in order to get his steering inputs to him, because he has to maneuver the ship very carefully dealing with all this flooding. And you're still in a heavily trafficked area. They figure out a way to do this. And it's kind of like you can see why the Navy's held in high regard. You can see why the benefits of having this culture of don't complain about the tools you're given, just fulfill the job, because there's a moment in crisis where you do need to be able to just focus on the job at hand and get it done. Mm-hmm. But my God, has that been exploited by basically everybody else above them in this situation? And that's the really astonishing thing here is the degree to which this rot has been allowed to fester. And a lot of people who have pointed it out over the years have been kind of encouraged to retire early, right? There's been no, if you were right about this, if you called that something like this was coming 4 or 5 years ago, nobody thanked you for that message. You were kind of shunned.
You had already been relieved of your, you had already been relieved of your duty for like speaking up in the first place.
Right. Last thing I'll just point out is in the second piece, just covering how the Navy got to the state, there's a couple things. Vern Clark, which was the Navy's top military officer during the Bush administration, started trying to run the Navy like a business and began streamlining warships to cut costs. And basically it's austerity for the Navy, right? Like, what positions can we eliminate aboard each ship to run them with a smaller complement, both to save money and to stretch the same number of sailors across more ships? And so they just kept cutting crew sizes aboard ships. And then the ships themselves are not even meeting those lowered requirements. And so ships that are supposed to be operating with like 300 people are operating with like less than 250, many of whom are very new at their jobs. And so that starts happening basically in part because of Iraq, where the Navy is being asked to send sailors into Iraq to sort of take up some jobs to free up soldiers for work in the occupation there. Part of it is also just, we have to cut costs and run this Navy like a business. The other interesting thing is with all the budget stuff that sort of marked all the Obama years with continuing resolutions rather than passing new budgets, because nobody could agree on what a budget should be. So you can only do a continuing resolution, which says whatever we spent last year, we're going to spend that again. You can't actually reallocate money within a continuing resolution. You're basically like copy-pasting last year's budget onto this year's, which means that whatever your needs were back when this first budget was passed that you were continuing to propagate, you have to keep spending money on those needs, even if those needs no longer really exist. And so, like, the Navy has this growing maintenance backlog that they can't just move money into because they don't have that budgeted. They do have money budgeted for buying more ships, so they just kept buying ships and equipment. And meanwhile, they couldn't actually like pull any of these ships into port and give them a thorough going over. So that's the other fascinating part of this. It's such a good article. And it is also, I don't know. It's scary, man. Like, with all the money, like, man, if the United States can't get a fucking, if you can't get a destroyer to sail out of harbor without hitting a cargo ship, right? Like, that seems bad. Like,
what other near misses do we just not know about?
That ship had already had like 3 near misses, like, yeah, in its time, in this like specific like time period. Like, this, like, there were signs. There were countless signs. There were countless moments in which, like, you know, disaster was nearly missed and like evident, like could happen at any time. The fact that they were using fucking Gmail because they're like, their internal like military emails weren't working, so they were just using Gmail on the ship, like, everything about this.
The fact that they have ship tracking software, they have the ship tracking radar that everyone is like, well, that's our ship tracking radar, so it shows us everything around us, right? So if that shows the area around us is clear, we're all good. And that really needs to be the case because the Navy no longer has enough sailors to post a port and starboard watch. Like, used to be a ship would run with somebody looking off the right side of the ship, somebody looking off the left side, just to say, like, hey, holy shit, there's something out there. Now, because of cost cuts, you don't have that. You have one person running back and forth trying to see, like, what's on either side of the ship. So there's a lot of reliance and trust put on this radar. And what apparently nobody, like, trained the crew on is the fact that the radar doesn't scan all the ocean all at once. You have to sort of set, like, where is it scanning, right? Where is it looking? And the radar was set to look at distant ship tracks. It was not actually scanning what was around the ship, but nobody knew that. And so when they saw the radar sweep and they would say, hey, there's nothing around us, you could have looked out the window and seen that wasn't true. Oh, but everyone's like, well, the radar shows it clear, so we're all good. And you couldn't retune the radar because the button to tune the radar was broken and they taped it over. I get the United States spending priorities are grotesque. The United States spends way too much money on defense relative to social programs, social services. And so I get the complaint that, well, why do we care about what state the Navy is in? I think, one, this is reflective of a lot of dynamics mm-hmm. in American government right now.
Yeah.
The other part of this is, like, just my personal position is it's bad to have a massively expensive military that you don't need just for the sake of, like, carrying out an aggressive rapacious foreign policy. That's bad. What I think is actually scary to me and is in many ways worse is having a massively expensive military that appears to be very effective and competent and is not. Because at that point, like, you would say, the United States military is the best, most powerful in the world. What you see in a story like this is, I'm not sure, like, do we know what we have at this point? You know, if you gave the Navy a mission, how confident would you be that it would be carried out properly if, like, lives were on the line?
Also, where the fuck is that money going if not to, like, man these if not to infrastructure on these ships and enough staff members to man them? Like, where, like, this, like, this spending budget on this outrageous spending budget is, like, not even being allocated in a way that, like, can maintain what we're spending on, if that makes sense. Like, it just,
yeah, no, they don't, they can't, they have money to spend on new equipment and new ships. They don't have money to spend on maintenance. And so that's been the direction we've just been headed for ages, is just keep buying fancy new, which again points to another critique, is to what degree is the United States defense budget about enriching military contractors versus actually building a sort of strong and professional military? There's an element of, oh, if we can enrich contractors, then by all means we'll spend money. Once that equipment is purchased and the money's been given to contractors, we will shortchange everything else about effectively deploying and implementing and training people on those systems, because that's not the point.
Yeah,
right? The point is to get the money to the military industrial complex.
And the point isn't even to be, like, combat oriented or, like, combat ready. It is literally displays of force. Literally, yep. Just, like, sailing by our quote unquote, like, enemies and just showing off. So,
and that's the thing, right? Like, the Navy is used as this, like, threat so routinely. It is so often held up as, like, this United States Navy, the United States is the most powerful and competent military in the world. And here is a really ugly story that casts a lot of doubt on that. And that's the other part of this is, this is the kind of Navy that writes checks that it can't cash. Mm-hmm. And that's what this story kind of reveals. So it's a fascinating story. There are so many like amazing details in it. It really does, you know, read like a movie or a novel. It's incredible.
Well, so to that point, like one of the stylistic things that's interesting about how they chose to write out this story is that like it's very normally when you are like attributing like statements and quotes, it's usually like someone said according to blah blah blah, and so they put a footnote at the end that's like so. Kind of weird that like none of this says like where individual quotes came from, and like they just made a stylistic decision mm-hmm. that they things they found like let's say in you know a report or a log or an interview rather than attributing those like specifically to where they got them, like they just decided like we're just going to drop that part, we have done the due diligence to like find right. like this story, and actually it's more effective for it to be more cinematic, for like lack of a better term. Like they were basically making the argument that like it was to be more rhetorically effective was to remove some of like the journalistic trappings that can kind of make a sentence a little clumsier to read. Yeah. And I think it was the right choice because it does make the story more approachable and more gripping in a way that if it said like this specific quote was found yeah. in a government report, like it would have taken you out of it. In a way that for a story that is trying to tell like a very technical bureaucrat, like there's just so much in it and it's so long that I think it's an interesting stylistic choice that I end up agreeing with, but they do put a footnote that explains like why it makes sense for a Tom Clancy novel, makes less sense for an investigative right. report to not attribute like where the information is along the way. And so just if you're wondering like, why do they do that? Not others. Like there is your explanation because they made a conscious choice to kind of cut some of that stuff stylistically.
Right. I mean, for an article of this size to be and of this like hyper like bureaucratic like and like the fact that they got so much of this information from like confidential reports that included over 13,000 pages of documents, photos and transcripts of like sailor interviews, like for all of this information to be distilled in such a legible, like long form piece was like pretty incredible for me. Just to be able to like actually follow along everything that was going on in a subject matter that I don't have any context for. So I mean, the reporting here is like incredibly impressive. The amount of material that they drew from is just gargantuan. So the fact that it was all like just put into this very like accessible format was very impressive, and I hope to see more things like this in the future for like these types of investigative reporting. I think it's like a really positive thing. And
Well, the ProPublica model is it's not ad supported.
No, it's right, is a nonprofit.
Yeah, I don't know the exact. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if it just has like wealthy benefactors that are just like underwriting their work. But I don't want to speak out of turn. I don't know.
It says as a nonprofit, this is in their about page. ProPublica's work is powered primarily through donations. So seems like they have a staff of 75 journalists, which is pretty big.
Money well spent. They've done some incredible stories. Another place that does, and this is an increasingly important model we're seeing as local newsrooms dry up. Right? Is this model of like directly supported investigative reporting? Because you know. A lot of your profit-driven newspapers and media outlets are not going to allocate the time and resources necessary to get to the bottom of stories like this, right? Like, they will talk to spokespeople and maybe review a couple documents, but like in a lot of cases, like move on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's so important that like places like ProPublica are doing things like this. Places like The Reveal are investigating a lot of these really critical stories that. It's a shame that they're quick to fall out of the news cycle because there's so much important information and so much that is revealed about the state of the world, through telling these stories. So You know, you should definitely check out this series of articles they ran over at ProPublica. You should check out ProPublica. But yeah, this particular story, Fight the Ship, is just an incredible achievement and an incredible presentation. And I cannot believe such a long article like passed so quickly. Yeah. As I was reading it.
Yeah, totally.
So that will do it for this week's Waypoints. Our thanks to Too Mellow for the track Slide Asleep off the album After Midnight. You can find that at twomellowmakes.bandcamp.com. You can keep up with all of us at waypoint.vice.com. I'm Rob Zachney. You can find me on Twitter at Rob Zachney. Patrick, where can people find you?
At Patrick Klubik.
Natalie.
At Natalie Watson.
All right, well, we hope you've enjoyed the break. Please be sure to rate and review us on your podcast platform of choice, if it allows such a thing. Again, I like to think we're 5 stars, but that's for you to say, not me. I'm a man of the people. We'll be back again with, it's Waypoint Radio this Friday. And I think lore reasons is with Patrick, with Austin being on hiatus. I'm not sure when the next lore reasons is.
You'll just have to wait and see.
We're working on it.
Yeah. Don't worry. You'll get the lore. There's so much more lore. For you to get.
Well, you'll get something. I don't want to. That's that overpromise for lore reasons mission statement.
Lean into the mystery.
Lore is discussed. Whether what you get on the other side of that is.
All will be revealed on lore reasons in a comprehensive, authoritative, and 100% accurate podcast.
Sure.
Be sure and listen to our new podcast, Be Good and Rewatch It, where this week I think it's Patrick and Danielle diving into Sunshine, which you just referred to, Patrick. So you should check that out on the Be Good and Rewatch It feed. Hope you'll join us for that and join us again on Friday for Waypoint Radio. But until then, do not give in to astonishment.
Nice.
All right.
Cool.
Ooh, meaty pieces.
Meaty pieces.
Yeah, we need something a little lighter next week.
Everything is bad.
Yeah.
Everything is bad. The essay.
Like that Lego movie song that's everything is awesome, but it's actually everything is bad.
Everything is bad.
Everything is bad.
Next week I can talk about how much I did not enjoy Infinity War.
Oh, yeah? You just saw it?
Yeah, because I finally saw it. I was sick, and
I really liked Infinity War.
Yeah, I loved Infinity War. I do think part of that movie, like, being part of the cultural moment was probably somewhat important in, like, that aspect of it, because I could definitely see it not being nearly as, like, just as being part of the continuum.
I had no attachment to anyone because I haven't watched, like, I haven't kept up with this, like, iteration of the Marvel universe.
Sure.
Like, I've seen one, like, pieces of everything. Mm-hmm. Like, one in probably Civil War, in the Captain America series, I saw, like, one of the Thor movies, one, you know, like, I haven't, like, really followed it all to this point.
Yeah.
Catch me never watching Ant-Man and the Wasp. Sorry, Patrick.
Yo, that movie's pretty good, honestly, if you're going to watch any of them.
Yeah, come on. What you got
against
that?
Like, straight up honesty, it's like the better version of, like, what people like in Guardians of the Galaxy, even as someone that likes Guardians of the Galaxy. Like,
isn't Thor Ragnarok the best version of Guardians of the Galaxy?
Oh, that's the other thing.
Please? Yeah, Rob?
So I'm just saying,
One
of the other things Infinity War does is it totally fucks up Thor Ragnarok. Like,
why?
Basically, the end of Thor Ragnarok, basically what happens the second after that movie ends,
yeah,
is literally everybody is murdered.
Yes.
Like, Thor Ragnarok is like, woo, awesome, fun time. 30 seconds later, every single
surprise,
character in
bitch.
That movie. Yeah. And like,
it's fucked up. It's fucked up. That was a wild beginning because I...
This should just be on the pod next week.
Like, oh, yeah, we should just... Yeah, we should...
No, look, we'll do... Look, I... Like, we'll discuss it next week. Fine. We will talk about... Because it's not Be Good and Rewatch It worthy, but I have some feelings about Infinity War and the narrative integrity of Thor Ragnarok.
Okay.
So we're going to dig into that.
I'm interested. I have to.
When is Endgame out?
Endgame is a while out, isn't it?
No, it's like the spring.
April 26th.
Are you serious?
We got time.
Oh yeah. Shit.
Okay. Marvel comes out in 2 weeks.
Let's do a Marvel pod before
Endgame
comes out sure. Because I.
Okay. So do we want to? Then do we do be good and rewatch it?
Let's just wait.
Like Infinity War, Ant-Man and the Wasp,
no.
Endgame.
The three movies.
We have chosen, you know, a very specific narrative arc. Ant-Man and the Look, Wasp.
Natalie, because here's the thing, I think.
Yeah.
Ant-Man may be the key to this entire thing.
I'm going to be pissed if it is.
Also, it 100% is.
Yeah.
Who do you think should be the king, the key to this entire thing?
Who's left? I don't remember who's still alive.
Well, none of those people are really dead.
Yeah, I mean, but they're like dissolved into some other universe.
Ant-Man,
the Phantom
like,
Zone,
largely will probably be the linchpin on which like Endgame hangs on.
Yeah. Wow, do we have Marvel. A Paul Rudd through line right now that we're
yes,
writing?
Yes, we do.
Yeah, we do.
Wow. We do.
You know what? There are worse things to have. You know, you got to pick them.
So what's next? Like Knocked Up? Was he in that movie? 40-year-old. What's the one? This is your 40s.
He was in. I don't know. I don't watch
the classic Judd Apatow. This is your.
Isn't that a movie? That's a movie. I'm not a liar. This is your 40s, Paul Rudd.
What?
This is 40. There's a movie called This is 40.
Okay, that's okay.
With Paul. Oh, okay. God. Paul Rudd and Leslie Mann. Are they married in real life? They should be.
Mm-hmm. No, she is married to Judd Apatow.
Oh, makes sense. Okay. Acting is weird. I would not direct a movie where my... I don't know
what else is weird is Paul Rudd looks older and clueless than he does in Ant-Man.
Yeah, he's... Yeah,
True.
It's like, oh, shit. Like, why does he look... better now.
Hey, were people freaked out? Did you post a Twitter poll? Was that a Twitter poll you posted about Clueless?
No, so BuzzFeed already ran a poll.
Oh, I see.
And so I was like, somebody surely has examined this question. So that is the people speaking on BuzzFeed.
But were people freaked out at the time is my question.
No, I do not remember that being any kind of narrative. But, like, the internet didn't exist. Like, would I even know?
Yeah, the internet exists. It was 1995.
The internet barely exists.
There's a forum. Yeah. There's a chat room.
There was AOL, man.
You are not allowed to authoritarily wait on what it was in 19...
When I was...
Excuse me.
When I was Natalie, born, there were forums.
Natalie, if you want to see what the internet was like
in
1995, you need to watch You've Got Mail.
I've seen that.
Because that is a 100% accurate documentary. Well, then yes, there you know what it was like.
It's been a while, though.
You were getting catfished by Tom Hanks. That's what the internet was.
Damn.
Just all the time.
Who among us has not?
We were all like, that's why my parents like wouldn't allow me on AOL unsupervised, because they were like, Tom Hanks is on. He's online.
You read that Bloomberg piece about Tom Hanks, right?
Oh, my.
Wait, is there an actual
Bloomberg? No.
Okay, I was like, oh, no.
Have we lost Tom?
No, if Tom Hanks gets canceled, then you know, man, what the fuck's the point of anything anymore?
It's all over.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't have attachments to anyone because I'm just waiting for that cancel button. Bing, bing, canceled. Bing, bing, you're canceled, bitch.
What? Wait, what?
Yeah, you haven't heard that on social media when people.
When you get canceled, bink, you go bink, bink,
bink. You're canceled.
You got bink, binked.
Bink, bink.
Anyway.
The Twitter mob's coming for you. Bink, bink. It's like the Warriors come out and play. Bink, bink.
Are we doing Clueless at 3? We're doing Clueless at 3, right?
3:30.
Awesome. Bink. Hard out at 6.
Yeah. Yeah, I got to.
We should not. We will not run into your heart out with Clueless. I do not think.
I don't think so either.
Though it is a dense film.
It is.
So much happens in Clueless.
A lot happens. A lot happens in Emma.
Yes, that's. This is the thing. We'll get to that.
I read the Spark Notes.
For this show?
For Emma.
Awesome. Well. We get to the bottom of that 3:30. All right, everybody.
Okay.
Right. See ya.
Pink, pink.
World. Today's holiday is World Day of Social Justice. Rise up.
Big day for the woke gamer.
Rise up, woke gamer. Hi.
Are we actually doing mine first, Rob?
Pardon? Yeah, we are.
Okay.
Let's count in.
All right. 31.
Shall we go 31? Yeah, I fucked it up.
My
it was so bad.
Oh my goodness.
I didn't know my hands could nervously fart, but they did.
Mine froze.
Rob's, like, I really wish I had to get it.
I missed it. I was looking at the clock.
Damn. All right.
Let's try again at the top of the minute.
Okay. A blessed top of the minute clap. Rob clap.
Yeah. This is a man's podcast now, Patrick. That's right. Run home to your mama. All right.
I'm excited for this.
It's just okay.
Oh no, I might have the giggles.
Kato, can you just include all of this?
Yeah, it's all
like parts of this in
Oh no.
Just put at the end.
Are we not doing phrasing?
I think I've got the giggles.
Okay. All right.
Ooh, shake
people
it
lost their homes in this. Come on. Think about the people in Mount Pleasant.
No.
I'm trying to get sad. This is some heavy shit.
This is a really intense I'm already emotional.
I'm trying, Rob, to get sad. Exactly. Okay.
Sadney.
Fuck it. We'll just talk about the AAF.
That's fine. Do you honestly just flip it to the top and we'll just get this out of our system?
Okay.